Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Negotiation. It's scary. And when we're scared, we may not be at our best. For example, we may capitulate prematurely. We may unduly harden our position. We may even be unethical. Here to help us negotiate better is Seth Freeman. Since 1994, he's been teaching negotiation at Columbia and NYU, as well as to executives, students, and UN diplomats around the world. He's also the professor of one of those things called, they call the Great Courses, which I love. I'm always listening to one when I'm in my car. His is called The Art of Negotiating the Best Deal. As well, he is the author of a book called The Ready and Able Negotiator, and forthcoming, The Trust Problem, How We Turn Danger into Hope. Seth Freeman, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure indeed. Well, I've been a career counselor for a zillion years, 5,000 clients, and I have found that unless a job seeker is a star or has a rare but in-demand skill set, he or she has little power when negotiating compensation. I mean, the average candidate has job searched for months, is grateful to finally get one job offer. So the job seeker has got no walkaway power. And equally challenging, most job seekers are just not able to accurately enough assess what their fair market value is. Because sure, there's a lot of publicly posted salary information, but that's rarely comparable enough to their particular situation. And if you try to get the answers from the employees, hey, how much do you make? They're rarely going to discuss their compensation package. So do you have any advice in that situation?
Yeah, I do. The first thing is, it is difficult when you have no alternatives. I mean, this is, in a sense, what a hostage faces. When you have no alternatives to agreement, you're pretty much at the mercy of the other person. So if there really is an extreme disparity, then yeah, it is going to be more difficult, and it's worth knowing that going in. But that said, it's not worth throwing in the towel. There are definitely things that you can do to improve your prospects. And the first thing is to prepare. I realize that, as you say, it can be difficult to get specific information, but all the research suggests that your chances go up considerably, sometimes dramatically, if you've done the right kind of preparation. And that means, first, identifying what are your interests. And that can seem like a silly thing. Well, I want more money. But think about this. What is the difference between saying, I want more money, and saying, I need to provide more for my family? If you draw that distinction, well, the first way of framing it means there's only one answer, more money. And if they can't give it to you, that's the end of the story. But if your framework is, I need to provide more for my family, there may be several ways to make yourself happy, and some of them may very well be things that the employer can give you.
One of the axioms, though, in negotiations is the employer doesn't give a damn about your family. The employer gives a damn about, at best, fair market value, and at minimum, how can I get this person as cheaply as possible? Isn't the answer normally, hey, I can provide a lot of value for you in this way, and this way, and therefore I'm worth more money? Why do you think the person gives a damn about your family?
She doesn't, and it's certainly not the idea that you want to go in saying, give me more because I need it. That's absolutely not the idea. It's what you're thinking about that's critical.
So what do you say? Instead of, if that's what you're thinking, what do you actually, let's take a real example. Let's say I am, and this is the typical situation, and employers like to do this. They give the job offer by email, and they list the term sheet with the salary and the benefits and the other terms specified. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's not a terrible package, but it's not a great one. What would you suggest I do? Not think in my head. Well, you can tell me what I can think in my head, but what should I act? How should I respond?
Well, the first thing is to do your homework. Make sure you've got a basic groundwork of understanding of what this offer represents. Is it indeed out of the bounds? And as much as you can do homework to find out.
What kind of homework can I, as I said, those public, I see the salary, I go to salary.com or I go to payscale.com, and I see these, they are zip code adjusted, I'm well aware, but they're so difficult to make comparability given your relative strengths and weaknesses. What kind of homework in this most typical employee job situations, job search situation, what kind of homework can I realistically do?
Well, there are a couple of tracks. One is precisely what you're describing, online research, and there are some other sources that may be useful, like, for example, JobStar, and with the Riley Guide, salary is a good search term. It can guide you to other salary surveys. But let's say that's a dead end. You don't find the research that you want. What else can you do? Just a quick footnote. I have a friend who was looking for a job at a major Fortune 500 company. He went to one of these salary surveys, parsed and parsed. He found exactly what the guy he'd replace was currently making. And it really doesn't get much better than that. So there are certainly cases where you really can learn things that are very valuable.
And Glassdoor can do that sometimes, too. Glassdoor is more recent. JobStar has been around a long time. I haven't looked at it lately. But certainly it is true that Glassdoor, sometimes, especially disgruntled employees, they can post their experiences at a particular company. And as a way of sticking it to the employer, sometimes they can say, hey, by the way, here's what we make here for this, and here's the here are the various salaries.
Mm-hmm. To your point, yes, it can be splotchy. So another way to find out what is reasonable is to do information interviewing, to actually speak to people it's appropriate to speak to, who may have knowledge about the specific company or industry that you're involved with. That doesn't mean going to a future colleague or asking somebody, asking a secretary at that company. It might be inappropriate and offensive, but there may be people who you know something about the company that you're going to work with, and that kind of inside information is valuable. And, we're really playing the averages here. You're batting for average. There's no guarantee of anything. But just to take one quick example, think of the sports agents. Sports agents' livelihoods, their profession, is salary negotiation, essentially. And so they are continually doing this very kind of work. They're looking online, but they're also trading notes with each other, trying to understand what is going right here, what can I learn informally and formally that can give me a better sense of what's reasonable.
You told me an interesting study off the air, which makes sense to me, that the HRP, they did a survey of HR people, and the HR people have very little discretion over salary, but they have much more discretion over other things. You want to tell us more about that?
That's right. In 2009, there was a nationwide survey of HR executives, and the question was, what are you doing on salary? And keep in mind, this was right after the financial crisis hit, and so we're in the depths of that awful economy. And as you might expect, they said, well, we're being told to hold the line. And what are the candidates saying? Well, they're pushing back. And what are you saying? Well, we're holding firm. And how are the candidates responding? They're upset. Well, so far, no surprises. But then the survey asked, is there anything else you would negotiate? And the answer widely was yes. We would negotiate, like what? Vacation, start date, moving expenses, in some cases certain other benefits. Are the candidates asking for these things? No. And since they're not asking, we're not offering.
Okay.
So there's that double disconnect.
So that's certainly one takeaway, that you can, even if they're holding the line on salary, there are other things you can and should negotiate. Let's take us back to that moment.
If you'll forgive me just one second, that's exactly the point. When I was saying that you need to know what your deeper needs are, for example, providing more for your family, mm-hmm. if you know that is your goal, mm-hmm. then there are many other options that you might well ask for, such as the ones you, Marty, have just enumerated, and that's how you can win in more than one way.
Fair enough. So take me to that moment now. You've been like, I'm really not painting a worst case nor best case scenario. Typical scenario, job seeker's been searching a few months, he's not a rock star. Obviously, if they're a great data scientist from Harvard, they're going to have no problem. There's no issues. But if you're your typical person, graduated with a bachelor's in liberal arts from San Francisco State, has got a checkered job history, now looking for at least a few months, maybe the person is also older, and looking for a job a few months or longer, finally gets a job, he gets a term sheet, he's really excited, or she, of course, and it's okay, it's not a great offer. We've done the homework, as you said, as well as we could. We recognize we don't need to limit ourselves to just negotiating salary. We want to think about it in our brains that we're caring for our family. Okay, now behaviorally, how do I respond to that email offer?
Well, the first thing I would do is respond with thanks for this offer. I'm glad to hear of it. I'm confident we're going to come up with something that we're happy with. I have a few questions. I wonder if we might speak. And the reason you want to do that is, first, you want to signal that you're positive and collaborative and optimistic. You want to be, you want to look like you're, and you are, very constructive in your approach. But you also want to try to avoid doing this by email, because the research suggests that email tends to produce more no's
right.
than face-to-face.
Makes sense. That does comport completely with my experience. So, okay, so now I'm there, and I'm terrified. You know, many job seekers I have who are not stars, they've waited so long for this offer, they're terrified that if they negotiate too hard, they're going to have the offer pulled. And indeed, I've had that happen both to some clients, and it happened to me. I had my own seven-minute segment in prime time on CNN, and they had me do it, would you believe, for nothing. Here they talk about always advocating for labor, but they had me work for zero. But finally, after 13 weeks, I say, you know, I'll mention the guy's name, Lou Dobbs. He was the big guy at CNN. And I say, you know, can you see your way clear? You know, I've tried to demonstrate that I can produce reliably, and well, you've praised me throughout the 13 weeks. Can you see your way clear to pay me at this point? Like, CNN is, oh, they're broke. I say, he says, I'll get back to you. I get an email, of course, 3 days later, your services will no longer be required. One line.
I'm so sorry, Marty. That's frustrating as can be.
So many job seekers are afraid after looking for all this time. They're saying, okay, I certainly don't want to blow it. I don't want to negotiate too hard. What would you tell me if I were that person entering that negotiation?
Well, the first thing to do is put this in perspective. I've taught thousands of students from around the world to negotiate, many of them business students, and I can count on one hand how many times a student has said, the mere act of asking to negotiate has lost me the job. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen. You do definitely get horror stories from time to time. It may be increasing, but it's hard for me to know if this is a widespread phenomenon.
I need to respond to that. First of all, remember, because you teach at Columbia and NYU, and when you get paid good bucks to go around, you're fine. I know you're a really good instructor, having taken your course.
Thank you.
You're paying serious dollars, and therefore, the people who can afford to pay are really fairly elite. And if they did get a job, they'd be embarrassed to tell you. So for many reasons, you're not seeing a reasonably random selection of the people who are looking for jobs. There are jobs that do get. I don't want to tell a lot of stories, but I certainly have had. I'll never forget this perfectly fine but average person who had applied for a job at an insurance company. They offered her $58,000. She asked for $60,000, and they pulled the offer. They said, you know, we have plenty of applicants, and we made you a fair offer, and if you think that was unfair, you're going to be disgruntled, and I'm sorry, thank you very much for your interest.
Well, you're absolutely right. It does happen, and precisely because I wanted to make sure I was not just living in a glass bubble, I did a little research online in advance of our conversation this afternoon, and I do find that it still is seen to be something of an exception. There are even companies that have made a policy of not negotiating, like Reddit. But you're right; it does happen, and so let's work on the premise that let's say I'm the one who's negotiating, and I might be the unfortunate one who's faced with somebody like this. What do I do? And so the first thing I would say is prepare. You want to be, that's kind of, if there's nothing else that our listeners take away from this conversation, let it be, you want to prepare. There's systematic ways that you want to get ready. This is not about flying by the seat of the pants. It's not about bluffing. It's not about thinking fast on your feet. It's quite the opposite. Preparation, all the research says, is crucial to your success.
We've talked about the kind of preparation. We've said that we've talked about the advantages and limitations. Other than looking for these salary surveys and hoping you also get to talk to somebody who has good information, or is there any other practical or psychological preparation that we need to talk about before we move past preparation?
Well, yes, there are a couple of things, but if you'll allow me to just hold off on that for just a moment,
sure.
Just because I do want to address the immediate question:
sure.
What do you do about this danger that the other person might just pull the offer?
Mm-hmm.
Assuming you've done your preparation, then the next thing I would do is say, thank you for this offer. I wonder if you can tell me how negotiable it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you short-circuit the surprise. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the mere fact that you've asked is enough
like
to destroy it.
Mm-hmm. Now you wanted to. Was there any other preparation you want to tell me, or have we gone to that well too much?
Well, no, I think there are a number of things. Perhaps the most important thing is alternatives to agreement. If you can't reach an agreement with this employer, what are you going to do instead? Now, in a sense, that's very obvious, because a job seeker is constantly trying to find different opportunities, different offers. And, you know, if you do have two offers, that's so much better than having one. But this is not quite as obvious as it might first think, as you might first think, because it may be that there are other alternatives that haven't been considered yet that are worth considering. For example, you can go back to school, you can become Mr. Mom or Mrs. Mom, you can decide to write the great American novel. Many of them may not be plausible, but some creativity might reveal, there actually is something I can do with my time besides just seeking a job in this particular with this particular company. And all the research shows that the better you have a sense that you have an alternative to agreement, the more effectively you can negotiate with the other person. But that's not the only thing to develop. We've talked about several things. Do you know what your needs or interests are? Do you know what the facts of the situation are? And that's not just what are the salary comparables at other firms. There are a lot of other things that you want to learn too, like what are going rate, but also what are what's the rumor mill say about this company? What is the person you're going to be negotiating with's reputation? What are the prospects and needs of this company? What are the specific duties that you're going to be doing? The more you understand the facts and situation, your ability to master the budget that you and your wife or you and your husband are going to be living with, that sort of detailed understanding of the situation can surprisingly pay off as we go along the line.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Seth Freeman. He is a professor. He teaches negotiation at NYU in Columbia. He also does teach you executives and students, and he's taught to UN diplomats. He's gone all around the world. He's a great teacher. I've taken his what they call one of the great courses. It's called The Art of Negotiating the Best Deal. It's what I listen to when I'm in my car. I've just completed it. I really commend it to you. I want to take a very specific situation, which is may allow us to gain more nuance. I have just had I'm delighted that I'll just say a very prestigious, I'll say university, okay, it's the truth. A very prestigious university has asked me to give a very public presentation that's open to the general public. It's one of the things that they do to kind of show their community involvement or whatever. I did it 4 years ago for them, and I'm grateful and flattered that they've asked me to do it back, to come back. They are offering to pay me, I will just say, under $500. It will certainly take me, this is not just an off-the-cuff thing. I said, how much time I spend preparing for this radio show. You can imagine what I'm like preparing for a really important thing like that.
And I'm just going to affirm that. You've been remarkably professional and delightful to work with, and you really do your homework.
You're very kind. So, in any case, I get an we met in person to negotiate what I would talk about, how I do it. It's going to be streamed, and then they're going to make little videos of it, little clips of it, and they will get a lot of mileage out of this, right? I then at the end of it, I always, as you know, we try to defer the negotiation compensation until the right moment after kind of we've worked things out and gotten everybody excited.
Yep.
So everybody's excited, and I get home. And it pops to me that he never mentioned compensation, nor had I. So I informally sent him a little email that simply says, "Oh yeah, tell me about what's the most you'd be comfortable paying me for this, right? The most you'd be comfortable." I like that phrase. He comes back to me, says, "I know it's modest, but we can pay you $400." Right now. Right, per hour, that means I could have made more money flipping burgers at McDonald's, and this is this highly prestigious thing. I'm not chopped liver. I have a PhD from Berkeley. I taught there, the whole thing. So how would you... my emotional, visceral reaction was? It's not like, what is he going to offer me, $600? It's not going to change my life. I don't want... Even if he doesn't pull the offer, which I don't think he would, I think it would... I just don't want to fight over $200 and create any bad feelings. On the other hand, what would you psychologically and practically tell me to do in this actual, real, in-the-moment, current situation?
Well, I would take a step back, and the first thing I'd want to know, Marty, is what do you care about? What are your interests here?
Doing it. I would, off the record, I would pay him $500. I don't. Money is not my issue, but it feels cosmically unjust. You know, especially when these prestigious universities are always telling their students, advocate for labor fairly, raise the minimum wage, whatever. If they paid me the living wage that's now the rule in San Francisco, they would have paid me at least $1,000 for this. But no. Anyway, what do you think?
Sure. One of the key words you've mentioned is prestige and prestigious. And one of and the industries that are prestigious are notorious for paying less because
yep.
the compensation
yep.
is psychological. The prestige. You're not getting paid anything to read scripts in Hollywood. I know, but it's Hollywood.
Right, exactly.
So that's true. And I can tell you as a professor that it's very rare, if ever, that when I ask somebody to come in and guest lecture, I get a no. People love to do this. So that is indeed part of what you're faced with. So it may well be that even though, you know, a prestigious university can plead poor math, say, well, you know, we're a nonprofit. Actually, we're
right.
extraordinarily wealthy. They often do get away with this. So
yep.
I guess I would say if what really matters to you is fairness, then I might say,
yes.
well, okay, what other things besides money might be of value to you?
Hmm. I love, you know, we discussed in advance, it's in both of our interests to disseminate it very widely so they get maximum. So that's what I care about impact.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been discussed already, and that's, I can't do any better than that. I don't care about the money. I don't really have any other desires. I'm grateful to do it. I love doing that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff because it makes me feel like I'm making a difference. I don't know what else I want. What else might I want?
Well, what I hear you saying is fairness is also a sign of respect, a sign of valuing your time.
And cosmic justice. It's not even about me. There's something hypocritical
mm-hmm.
about people, especially if they pontificate about treating workers fairly and then
mm-hmm.
they don't treat workers fairly.
Mm-hmm.
It just offends my sense of justice, a part of whether it's me or somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
If it's you, if you, Seth Freeman, were telling me that Harvard wanted to pay you $400, you know, I'd be offended. I'd think that'd be outrageous.
And you know, you can go further and say that many adjuncts are treated in
right, exactly.
Way. So it's a pretty wide
horrible,
thing.
Horrible.
And what I might do, if one way that you can improve the situation, say, I understand you don't have any money in your budget necessarily, but I wonder if there are other budgets that might be appropriate that we could look to. I wonder if somebody can co-sponsor this. And that's just one example of many where you're starting to get creative, where you're coming up with creative options that think outside the boxes. Now, you have to keep in mind that these institutions tend to be fairly ossified and fairly siloed, and often they have very little bargaining room because they simply, well, I'm just a humble cog in a large machine. So this is why studies find that skilled negotiators do best when they brainstorm 5 options per negotiable issue. And I'm going to say that again. They brainstorm 5 creative options per negotiable issue. And I always tell my students, I don't want them to be excellent negotiators. I want them to be outstanding. And so I urge them to brainstorm 6. And I would probably want to sit down with you more and spend more time learning the exact particulars of the situation, Marty. But my first advice would be, once you're clear on what your interests are, what you've just enumerated, and you've got a sense of what the factual situation is, I would want to brainstorm lots and lots of options, the good, the bad, and the ugly, just like they do at IDEO, right where you are in Silicon Valley. They generate dozens, hundreds of ideas. They call it a deep dive, as you probably know. And they do it because in there is a solution that might actually work. It doesn't always work, but it ups your average.
I want to move away from me for sure. Something that you've talked about when you do your trainings again, or they're all not only at Columbia or NYU, but all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You say one of the more valuable activities you do is something where you play Pat Gray, the negotiator from
yeah.
hell.
Yeah.
And so you know the negotiator from hell might say, "Where do you get the nerve asking for that?" Or "Take her to leave it." Or
mm-hmm.
they use a lot of double talk, and they say, "Well, you know, our scale has a multivariate analysis, and the multiple regression implies that where you really belong is at about $17 an hour." You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How would you deal with you know, any non obvious advice
sure.
for how to deal with a Pat Gray?
Well, sure. First, what you and I are now doing, role-playing, studies find, is an extremely effective way to cope with the emotional challenge of negotiation. It's real easy for me to sit here in a room and say, oh, it's really good to go prepare. That's true. But we all know that there are deep emotional stresses and strains, and one of the best ways to cope with that is to role-play. It's precisely why Olympic athletes do something similar before they perform at the Olympic Games. They visualize. And when you role play, you're actually in the emotional reality of the situation you're about to enter into. So this is a very important thing that I train students to do. So to the specific question, what then do you do if Pat Gray starts talking about double, you know, multivariate analysis? The first thing that I want my students to learn above all else when I begin my training is you've got to learn the talent of fighting the fear of looking dumb and then asking dumb questions. And Nobel laureates like Richard Feynman will tell you, if you don't really understand something clearly enough to explain it to a 20-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. And so simply saying to Pat Gray, Pat, I'm so sorry, I didn't understand what you were just discussing, multivariate analysis. Can you say that another way, please?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, we all are so afraid of appearing dumb. It really is. But I think that's a great tip, dear listeners, you know, really asking for re-explanation. Simply, sometimes just literally, you don't understand it. You're a human being. You are not expected to be perfect. But sometimes they are games playing. You know what? I think we should go to the phones.
Please.
So, dear listeners, if you have, especially if you have a negotiating situation, either side of the table you're on, whether you're the employer or the employee, and it doesn't have to be pre-employment. It could be, you know, very often if you're a manager, you're negotiating a contract with a vendor, with a customer, with a potential donor to your charity. Or, you know, there are a lot of negotiations around things like when people are making complaints about race or discrimination, wrongful termination. Negotiation is pervasive, of course, in and out of the workplace. If you are in the throes of a negotiation or have one coming up, this should be particularly welcome as a call to the show, Work with Marty Nemco, and my special guest, Seth Freeman, negotiating lecturer, teacher, trainer extraordinaire. The phone number here at KELW and Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, let's talk about those other kind of compensation negotiations. Let's say contracts. Let's say you are United Way, and you're entering into negotiation with a smaller nonprofit to do their marketing for them. Mm-hmm. What's a principle or tactic that we haven't yet discussed that might be relevant in that situation?
Well, let's see, there's several. I think the overarching idea is whether you are an enormous entity or a small blip in a negotiation, the readier you are, the more you can create what Harvard professor of negotiation Leonard Susskind, I always get his first name wrong, Susskind, says is a good for you, great for me outcome. And that's worth lingering on for just a second, because the conventional wisdom is it's got to be a pitch battle. The more I get, the less you get. But actually, both of you can be very happy, and one of you, hopefully you yourself, can be extremely happy if you do the work well. And that means both thinking of a creative approach and a competitive approach at the same time. And one of the best ways to do that is to package, to go in and be ready to offer more than one a proposal on more than one issue at once. That allows you to propose trade-offs, whereas a naive negotiator might go in and just talk one issue at a time and never see the possibility for trading one topic for another.
Makes good sense. Do you want to share one more? If you know, you were a lawyer before, you were a corporate lawyer before, and I know you were just an associate at that point. They didn't probably put you in charge of big negotiations. But is there any in a contract kind of negotiation?
Yes.
Is there one other tip you'd like to give our listeners before we go? All our lines are lighted up, so we're going to go to the phones in a second. But is there one tip you'd like to offer?
Yes. I think the central idea is go slow to go fast. And don't rely on Hollywood to tell you how to negotiate. If you think that the way to negotiate is the way they do it in Breaking Bad, then I want to encourage you that is exactly the right way to negotiate if your goal is to increase the drama, risk, and danger, which is exactly the opposite of what any real negotiator wants to do. So really good negotiating is boring, and the reason it's boring is because people are listening to each other, and listening is extremely boring to watch, but extremely powerful. And if you want to know one of the most important skills of a negotiator, it's listening. And one of the proofs of this is the New York Police Department hostage negotiating team's motto is "Talk to me." And they've learned that the way you get a seemingly impossible counterpart to agree and put the gun down and let the kid go is to do extremely disciplined, skilled listening. So counterintuitively, slow down, listen, and let things flow from there.
And one of the keys to listening and gaining giving respect to the person, say, tell me more about that, or what am I not understanding? Mm-hmm. The more questions are the key to slowing down and understanding. Mm-hmm. And I'm so damn guilty of not doing this. I am decrying hypocrisy. Well, I'm a huge hypocrite, but I'm talking to myself and maybe to you, my dear listeners. Slow down negotiations with questions and with listening. Now, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My special guest, Seth Freeman, negotiator par excellence. What's your question or comment for him? Hi, it's you.
Me?
Yes, it is.
Great. Thanks. Catherine?
Hi, Catherine.
I started working about 3.5 years ago for a startup. I was an employee, the fifth person. There were engineers, the founder, and me. An angel investor called me up one day, and I had managed a business for her. And she said what she had to close, and she said, "Are you looking for a job?" I said, "Yeah, sure, it sounds good." And so she said, "They need an office mom." So I started off, highly recommended by her. She brought me in, at a very low hourly rate, part time. Now I've been there, and I've set up all the office functions. I did accounting, I did purchasing, I did HR for them. They've grown to 70 employees now, and they've been through 2 rounds of financing. Mm. But the CEO has never valued the office function. He's a nerdy engineer, and the engineers get all the money. I know what everyone makes because I did payroll as well. Now I have an opportunity. I've actually already been transferred to another manager in the business development section, because they do think very highly of me and my organizational skills. And in the past, I've done project management, people management, in tech for decades. But because I had to start in office, that's where people know me, and so far it's been a lateral transfer, and I need I need a better salary. I know what everyone makes. I know I should be making almost double what I'm making right now to be on par with other people.
What's your advice, Seth?
I'm sorry, I don't think I got your name.
Catherine.
Thank you, Catherine. First, Catherine, it sounds like this is a frustrating situation. You've done really good work, and you're not getting recognized, even though your reputation is strong there. And I've had students who've been in exactly that situation. Have you taken the new position yet?
Yes, I did. And I've seen no paperwork for it or anything. I've already been sucked into the job, and I've transitioned. I've had to train, my boss to do the stuff I was doing before.
How long have you? It sounds like you accepted the position at the same compensation.
Well, I assumed there'd be a discussion about it. Okay. And I've a couple of times. I just had a one-on-one with my boss last week, which was, I thought I was preparing myself to talk negotiation and salary, and I'd mentioned it to him in the past, and there's been no room for it. And last week, our one-on-one turned into a group meeting.
I see.
And I had no.
And how long have you been in the new position?
About 3 weeks. Three weeks.
And the toughest question, if the answer was, this is all there is, do you have an alternative?
Well, I guess start looking around. The only thing I can think of I would love to have more vacation, or I would love to work fewer hours.
No, I'm sorry. In other words, if you left there, do you have an alternative that you could go to or do or think?
I'd go back out into the market. I think I could I could do office management for sure, even though that's not my, that wasn't what I spent decades doing before 2008 when I was laid off, but I could probably get back into my field before that.
But, am I reading you right as I'm listening to you? You dread the thought of doing that. Is that accurate?
I totally dread the thought of doing
right,
it.
Right. So you really are, like as I was saying earlier, you're one of the most of the job seekers I know really don't have much leverage. So given that situation, Seth,
right.
Do you want to take a shot at telling what you would say, or you want me to take a shot at this one? Up
well,
to you.
Let me give you a thought or two, and I would love to hear what you think, Marty, too. When it feels like you don't have any alternatives to agreement, there are basically two things that you need that you want to do. One is check and see if that really is true. Really, you want to see, well, you know, what would a headhunter say? What would what did the market say? What do my friends who are doing other things say? It might be that, oh my gosh, I've been missing something big here, and I've really been short selling myself. So that's, I would warmly encourage, even if it's a little uncomfortable, it might be a real low-risk, high-return thing to at least find out what else is out there. But regardless, when, let's assume that the answer is, I just can't do it, don't want to do it, I find there's not much. When your alternatives are weak, it's absolutely essential to be prepared on the other fronts. And that especially means knowing what your interests are, what do you really care about, and also understanding what creative options you might be able to get that would serve those interests, even if it's not more money. So, for example, it might be they tell you, I can't, imagine, Catherine, they tell you, I'm sorry, Catherine, I can't give you any more cash this year. Is that the end of the story?
Yeah, it shouldn't be.
Right, because listen to what he's saying. I can't give you any more money this year. So that invites the possibility, well, maybe there's somebody else who can. Or maybe it means there's something else besides money he could give you. Or maybe there's something, he could give you more cash next year. And so a no isn't necessarily the end of the story. And if you have different creative ideas in mind, there might be some that he can say yes to or somebody else can that would really serve you.
Okay.
Well, I'm also hearing, being not thrilled with that. I'm curious, both Catherine and Seth, what you think about this approach. There's one of my favorite words in almost all of transactions in life is the word crisp. I would try to be very crisp in there, and I would probably, whether it be verbally and or in writing, make say I need a meeting to discuss my changed job description, and with the person with the power to make the decision. Maybe if that's not my immediate boss, then to avoid jumping over my boss, I would say I need to meet with you, my boss, as well as Mary, whoever the big decision maker is. And I say it's important. I then, in preparation, I would list my job my job tasks before in the old job, and I would then list it on the right column. I would list all the job requirements in the new job, and then I would especially since you know all the compensation of everybody, you would say, let's look at what my requirements, my job description was before. And that's why my compensation was whatever, $20 an hour. But now look at these, and look how that lines up against what the other people are getting. And doesn't it seem fair to you, Mr. or Ms. Boss, that, you know, that 2X, you know, $40 an hour is more appropriate? Showing them that in black and white, and then say, and then ending with, what do you think, which are my favorite four words, is a way of being crisp, research-based, and... Yes, then you can, of course, as Seth correctly points out, maybe she'll say, you know, we don't have any money now. Then you say, well, you know what, maybe I need to cut back to 4 days a week because I can't. This seems cosmically unfair for me to be doing this 5 days a week. Or maybe if you allow me to telecommute 3 days a week, I won't have the enormous travel costs and wear and tear on my body and my car, you know, those kind of things. Catherine, what's your reaction? Seth, what's your reaction to that?
Marty, I just want to amplify everything you said. That is actually the larger part of the fuller answer that I would love to give. And actually, I wish I had said that first, truth be told, because I think that is exactly right. I think what that illustrates is you've done your homework. You know you have real benchmarks or independent criteria that both sides can agree to, the payroll. And that can ground the request in reality and show that I'm not being unreasonable here. And I really like your point that Catherine would be very well served by specifically asking for a time and a place to privately meet with her boss. All of that, I think, is of first importance. And my suggestion about creativity, I would say, is probably more icing on the cake.
Okay, Catherine, you're honest. No BS now. If you're going to be hanging up the phone now, are you going to do any of what Seth or I are suggesting, truthfully?
Oh, yes. I definitely think that the meeting, requesting a meeting, just and being specific about the job description. To be honest with you, there's been no job description given to me.
Well, it could be informal. Even if it's not written, you can lay out what are the, in bullet points, what were the things you were doing, what are the core things you're doing now. And now you have incurred, Catherine, an obligation. That is to call back. You are going to do this or I'll break your face. that's what's called Bronx language. That's why I'm a kid from the Bronx. Well, you're going to do this or else, you know? And then you're going to call back and you're going to tell us whether it worked or not, because our listeners will benefit from the real-world feedback, not this theoretical nicey-nicey talk on the radio, but what really happens. Sound good?
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to add one other thing that can amplify everything that Marty said and also that I said.
Great.
If you want to have a little bit more on this and also navigate what could be a gender dynamic, sometimes, as you may know, women face more challenge asking than men do. There's a kind of a social cost that women sometimes have to face that men don't have to put up with. It's really unfair. You can check out a post that I have on Huffington Post. It's called Winning Warmly. On Huffington Post, Seth Freeman, and it goes through three ways that women can and do lean in job negotiations.
All right. Well,
say that again, winning what?
Winning warmly. Just Google the phrase winning warmly, Seth Freeman, Huffington Post, and you'll see a post there on this very subject.
All right, Catherine.
Great, thanks.
Wish you the best. Okay, all the lines remain lighted up. People are inordinately patient waiting for Seth Freeman, who, by the way, if you're just joining, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Seth Freeman. He is a negotiator and teacher of negotiator par excellence. He's done it with executives. He's done it with students at Columbia. He does it with students at Columbia and NYU, as well as UN diplomats. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for Seth Freeman?
Hello, am I on?
You are.
My name's Robert.
Hi,
I'm
Robert.
Calling from Marin. I'm a retired physician, and I like doing lectures that combine mathematics and medicine. And I'm wondering about the appropriateness or inappropriateness of a certain negotiating position when I offer this to private high schools as a package. I don't really need any money. I'm lucky that way. Therefore, I'd like to, for instance, receive perhaps $1,000, $2,000 per package, and then donate back all of it to the university. I get the write-off, which I can use, and they get the benefit of the package. What do you think of that sort of negotiating? It could even be higher. I'm thinking like Hillary Clinton. Maybe I could get $318,000 for 20 minutes. You know, as she did lecture to Goldman Sachs or something like that. But no, I'm in all honesty, I'd like to donate the money back, but I don't like lecturing for free.
But isn't it a break even? I mean, if you've got to report the $2,500 in income, and then your $2,500 deduction merely is break even.
I guess there's no way to make that work then, huh?
No, that does that tax wise. That, you know, you have to report the income.
Yeah, I guess that's a wash in the taxes. I should have thought of that, Marty.
What I've done in those situations, for example, because I am, frankly, I'm in the same situation you are. I'm very great. I've not made a lot, but I am not a spender. And I've invested in Vanguard index funds for 30 years, and it's made me good money.
Correct.
So what I tend to do is I say, I want you to buy my books. I don't want cash. I want you to buy my books, and you give them out. That way, what I do care about is impact. So I am putting my books in people's hands, and you know, and they're paying, so I don't feel like I'm ripped off. They're paying money, but I'm getting the books out. That's my way. Is there anything you could give them in exchange for your fee
No. I can't, well, offhand, I can't think of something. It may come in my subconscious later, but that's one option, and I'll consider that. I mean, what do you do for people who have a lot of money, don't really need more money, but they don't like working for free? I find that really offensive, and I've always felt that way, even when I had no money at all.
Well, then if you feel the money would be, let's say you want to donate it, let's say you ask them to pay you, but then you donate it, maybe that school isn't your favorite charity. Maybe what you're really doing is redistributing money. So
right.
if your judgment is you don't need the money, but you feel that the money would be better spent on your first charity of choice, maybe the charity you've left in your will, get the pay from them, and then tell them that you're going to donate it to a favorite charity, which may make them more willing to pay you the big bucks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes some sense, and that's a thought. I'll give that some thought.
Seth Freeman, what do you have to add on this?
I think you've got a very good idea there, indeed, Marty. Just to put this in a larger perspective, most nonprofits typically can pay something like 80-85% of what corporations pay. It is true that schools are more hard-pressed, but even they might have some room to be flexible. It comes back to what you care about. So if what you care about is recognition, you know, there can be non-cash compensation, like, you know, some kind of honorarium. But if the idea is, look, I want some kind of financial recognition, but I don't. It's not that I need the money; it's that I just want something that acknowledges my contribution and recognition. Then, you know, maybe there's some sort of scholarship that could be involved. Maybe there's some kind maybe there's some access to some other
right.
Course that they offer.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I like that. You can use their gym facilities.
Only
kidding. I get that. I hear that, and those are some good ideas.
Yeah, rename the school in your honor.
All right.
Or maybe you're
maybe
in exchange you can give them a free colonoscopy.
Yeah, I've already had that. No thanks.
Right. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you so much. I can do my own.
oh, Jesus. All right. Get off the phone.
Okay. I'll see you.
All right. Bye, our lines continue to be fully lighted up. So, Seth, do you have time to stay with us through the hour?
I do, indeed.
Cool. Let's go back to phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nicol. My guest, Seth Freeman. What's your question or comment regarding negotiation for Seth?
Good morning.
Hi.
Hello, Marty. I just want to say I'm a huge fan, and my dad grew up in the Bronx, so
that's probably why
I feel connected to you. And thank you so much for taking my question. So I work for nonprofits in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my current assignment, I am going to be calling lapsed donors. So in the last 3 years, they haven't been doing a monthly donation, which they once did. So I have a script, and so I'm going to be calling people at their homes. You know how that goes. And I've been scripted to ask them I'm going to ask them, would you like to sign up again to give monthly donations to this nonprofit, which provides food for people with disabilities or elderly? And so then I'm scripted, if they say, no, I'm sorry, I can't, and I say, oh, well, can you give it a more moderate level? And then if they say no again, I'm supposed to ask them to do a one-time donation. And if not, then I'll just thank them again for supporting us in the past and then hang up the phone. Do you have any advice? Because, you know, I know how this goes when people cold call.
Absolutely. So. I hate it. I hang up all the time. It's really invasive. I don't mind getting things in writing, but a call makes me want to puke. Seth Freeman, any thoughts?
Well, let me take a step back, and I'm so sorry I didn't get your name.
Oh, my name is Sarah. I don't think I gave it to you. Hello, Seth. Thank you.
Hello. So it sounds like if you're working off a script, there may not be any latitude at all. So help me understand better what latitude you would like to have or do have.
Sure. They have entrusted me. They said if you want to rewrite it, make it shorter. So I think they're open to it. If I'm successful, I think I can do whatever.
Well, I think cold calling is indeed a very hard ask. I have a family member who did this for years, and it is grueling, difficult work. And I myself have done cold calling, and you're lucky if you can get just 10 or 15 seconds of attention, as you probably know. So I must confess that here I'd be pretty I wouldn't be terribly ambitious about what one might be able to achieve in this scripted conversation, but There is a wonderful book on the negotiation aspects of giving. It's called Getting to Giving, and it's by a Harvard professor. I think his name is Robertson, but it's, it'll come back to me. And it's all about, in a sense, how he helped raise $1 billion for Harvard. And the basic idea is you want to think about the needs of the donor. And what does the donor care about? And often what they care about are things that you might be surprised about. So the better you understand who you're calling and what might resonate for them, the better you might have a higher hit rate. And let me give you a quick example of how this actually worked for a student of mine. I had a student who was trying to raise money for muscular dystrophy and contacted a company that had given money in the past and said, we'd like you to renew. And they said, sorry, we can't, we just can't do it. Why not, she said. Well, the economy is bad and we've seen a drop-off in sales. Can you tell me? I'm so sorry about that. Can you tell me just a little bit more about what your concerns are? Well, actually, our demographics are for people in their 20s and 30s, and we're just not seeing the sales we used to. Ah, she said. Well, I'm very sorry. And if something comes up, you mind if I call you back? No, not at all. She does some research and she finds out that the Muscular Dystrophy Society is going to have a major fundraiser at the Intrepid aircraft carrier. It's going to attract 20s and 30 somethings. By the thousands, or by the hundreds. So she calls back and she says, how would you like to sponsor a booth at this event? You're going to be getting exposed to exactly your target demographic. And they said, can we sponsor it for $10,000, which was much more than they'd ever given before. Now, that's just, I realize that that's very different from scripting. But what it illustrates is that you might very well be able to get more than you first thought if you're tuned in better to the other person's needs.
See, that sounds great. Can I amplify on that, Sarah?
Sure.
I like role-playing a lot, so I'm going to pretend that I were you without, and that's right, you don't need a script necessarily, and you were saying that you didn't need a script. Let me tell you what I would do if I were cold calling, if I had to do this. I would start by saying, you know, I got to tell you, hi, I'm talking to you, Sarah. So, Sarah, I'm actually embarrassed even to calling you because I despise telemarketing calls myself. And here I am doing this, but it's for the charity I believe in so much, giving food to the disabled and the elderly. And I know, you are a really loyal contributor. And I'm just calling to ask you, is there anything we did that annoyed you, or that was there something that you feel you weren't getting, you know, you felt like it wasn't worth it or something? I just would like to listen. And then I would listen my butt off. And then afterwards, I would ask probably a follow-up question so it didn't seem like it was an obligatory listen. I'd ask any follow-up, and I'd be listening for clues as to what his emotional hot buttons are. You know, do they have a better charity? Are they getting older themselves? Are they experiencing a disability? Whatever the hell it is. And I would go and talk and try to expand on that. And then I'd probably avoid making the ask. I would probably then say, you know, it's certainly, we're really sorry to lose you. We feel we're doing such good work with folks. And I'd shut up, and then I'd listen and see if I could get her to voluntarily come back on board. Does that make any sense?
It does.
I think that's spot on, and I would just add that the research also shows that one of the best assurances of doing well in money raising, in fundraising, is to be yourself a giver. So it adds an authenticity. Mm-hmm. So one thing you might want to do is give even more to the charity itself. But one other thing to add, the book I was referring to is called Getting to Giving. It's by Howard Stevenson.
Mm. Very good.
Okay.
All
thank
right.
you.
Sarah, good luck. Thanks for calling and work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty. Thank you, Seth.
My
yep.
pleasure, Sarah.
Yeah, we only have a few minutes left. You know, I very quickly, I was talking about the, I mentioned the other kind of negotiations other than salary, you know, compensation negotiations. We talked a little bit about contract negotiations that very often people are involved in when they're negotiating with a vendor or a supplier. But also maybe the most thorny of all negotiations is around race, gender, sexual orientation, you know, those kind of Right. So let's say you, Seth Freeman, you were an employer. It could be for-profit, non-profit, government, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And you've got an employee, you call an employee into your office and you say, you know, as you know, you've been on an improvement plan. And unfortunately, as we've pointed out, we haven't seen sufficient improvement. So now it's painful to do it, but we need to let you go. And the person then said, I didn't want to say this until now in case you decided to keep me, but now I want to let you know that I've been in contact with an attorney and the EEOC, and we will be filing a wrongful termination lawsuit. How would you respond?
Well, as soon as somebody mentions lawsuit, it's a different ballgame, and it really is anything you say can and will be used mm-hmm. against you. Mm-hmm. And this is a very important example of a basic principle. When you are flooded, when you're threatened, when you don't know what to do, one of your best recourses is to listen and ask questions.
Yep.
Because it first it avoids your saying anything that yep. you're going to regret later. It gets you focused, it gets you into the game, and it endows the other person with a sense of dignity and respect that often is life and death crucial, which is, again, why the New York Police Department hostage negotiating team makes it the absolute central principle of their work, and thousands of others like them do, too. So in that situation, I certainly wouldn't say, well, can we talk about it?
Right,
maybe I can
right.
offer you this. Maybe I can offer you that.
Yeah, right.
That is not the thing. But
right.
rather you'd say, can you help me understand better, mm-hmm. more about what you're describing? And you might just want to listen. And you also would probably at some point need to say, this is really not something I can discuss. I know this is something I'll need to discuss with my general counsel,
yep.
but I appreciate your sharing more about it.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And I'm looking at the clock. We're just about out of time. I'm curious a little bit about, you know, you have done and you like to do all these trainings and
yep.
such. What, you know, there are many people who are listeners to this show who do training themselves.
Mm.
Are there any tips you have of what you've been doing it, you said, for a couple of decades now?
That's right.
Are there any tips you might have on how to avoid trainings? Too often are like these, think of the language, slam bam thank you ma'ams. Mm-hmm. You know, they're dazzling, they're wonderful, but they don't translate to ongoing changed behavior in the real world. For example, mm-hmm. negotiation, they may get cold feet or they may cut short the research or whatever. Do you have any tips on how to maximize the likelihood that what you do in that training actually gets enacted in the attendee's daily life?
Well, I do find that one of the most useful things is to continually go back to actionable things they can do the next day,
mm-hmm.
And to focus the work so that it translates into an actionable task, an actionable tool, an actionable
yep.
template, an actionable challenge. And by the very end, I want to walk through with them, here are seven things you can do tomorrow that will help you do that, and practices you can continually refer back to. So the object is not for it to be this cloud of theory, but to be extremely actionable. Also, it's great to be able to have a follow-up where you, mm-hmm. you one-on-one or in group, you say, let's see what's happened in the last
you
week, month or so.
You know what? We're out of time, but I want to, you've given me a softball here. So, okay, for my listeners who've been listening, what's the takeaway that you want to tell them or ask them before we say goodbye so that they can maximally increase the chances of their actually implementing what we've been talking about today?
Sure. I would say there are three things that are probably most important. We've said over and over in this segment, Marty, that preparation is crucial. And so I would say there are some very simple questions you want to be asking yourself before you go into the negotiation. They are, what are my interests? What facts can I learn? What creative options can I think of? And what are my alternatives to agreement?
Great.
If I can answer those four, I've prepared at least reasonably well. And that's the first thing. Second, listen. Make sure when you go into the negotiation, you don't feel like it's about showing how fast you are on your feet. Rather, slowing it down, asking questions, and listening is vital. And the third thing is grounding whatever you do in reality. You don't want to make these crazy George Costanza, I want it because it's a big number and it sounds good kind of requests. You want everything to be grounded in your research or as close to reality as you possibly can.
Well, thank you for keeping us real. Seth Freeman, if you want Seth Freeman to, or you're interested in Seth Freeman either doing some training for your corporate, nonprofit, government, or university, you can just, probably the easiest thing is just Google him. You'll find him, Seth Freeman, S-E-T-H Freeman, and you'll find him. Is that fair?
That's fair, and I do have a website, professorfreeman.com, and my email address is sf14@nyu.edu.
Thanks very much, Seth, for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
My great pleasure, Marty.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I'm looking at the clock. We're running late. Thanks, Joanne Marr. Next week, Barbara Nemco and me, we're going to debate what it really takes to be a fine leader and manager, plus workovers. Till next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.